Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in for this episode with Raghi Horner. Remember, shows are posted on Mondays and Thursdays. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and YouTube. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a review on iTunes. Before I play today's interview for you, I want to give a shout out to the great sponsors of Futures Radio Show. CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. To learn more about these sponsors and the important things they are doing for futures traders, be sure to click on their logos on our website. Today, I spoke with futures trader at Simpler Trading, Raghi Horner. We chatted about how she started to follow markets as early as 14 years old and her decision to start trading futures. Raghi shares with us her trading process, from the fundamental and technical aspect to her preparation and trade execution. She gives us a recent trade example, how she sizes her positions. We talked about journaling and trading psychology. So without further ado, let me take you right to the interview with Raghi. Raghi, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Anthony. I'm looking forward to this.
I am too. Let's start off with, how did you get your start in futures trading?
The futures side of what I was doing really evolved from what I was initially doing by way of investing that my mom got me started in about 14, 15 years old. I discovered futures a handful of years later. I mean, I was probably about 17, 18 years old, and they were just a lot more bang for your buck. I remember seeing how much initial margin I needed to move cocoa or corn, and I said, gosh, this is a whole lot easier than the stocks that I had been and look trading and writing covered calls on.
No way. So your mom got you started in futures when you were a teenager?
Indirectly, my father passed when we were very young, and mom ended up, you know, taking what was left of the grub stake and deciding that the best way to grow it would be in the markets. And she was, unbeknownst to her, very much a market timer. She just didn't know. She didn't have any formal education. She just knew the stock market was a great place to grow capital. And so she went about doing it. So when I got my first job, she said that 25% of what I make needs to go to her, and she's going to put it in the market and learn what she does. And so, of course, I started to fight that because I had no knowledge of what the markets could do at that age in my teens. But once I figured out what she was doing, that was it. I was hooked.
Oh, yeah. Once you start trading even a little bit, that's it. You're hooked. So going back to that moment, probably you were thinking to yourself, this is what I want to do, but you also had to go through school. Did you ever end up taking any extended education outside of high school, or did you get into trading right out of high school?
So high school was when I started playing around with it. In college, I really got serious. And my first year, I like to remind everybody who's kind of out there going, oh, college, trading, if you can do both, go for it. But I was on the dean's list my first semester of college because I was too busy, you know, one, partying, and two, looking at charts. And my GPA my first semester was 0.68, I think. I about flunked out of college because I thought, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. I just want to trade. But as my mom said, finish college and go do whatever you want. So that's what I did. I found the path of least resistance out of college, studied psychology, studied English, and started trading as soon as I had that diploma in my hand. Full time.
Very cool. And so when you started to trade, what products did you decide to trade? Because I'm a firm believer that the product actually picks the person. You know, I think if you go out and say, I'm going to trade X market before you even trade it, I find that to be tough because I feel that each market has to fit that person's personality, same with their strategy. So how did you go about picking the markets you ended up trading?
Sure. The the main market that I started off in was equities, because that was just what I had exposure to. My father had given us a lot of shares of IBM, so I've been tracking that. So covered calls on that was just a really easy way to generate income. But I really didn't feel like I was trading. And you're absolutely right, my friend. Futures just resonated with me. They still do. I actually find it hilarious how much people think they really understand about stocks because they own an iPhone. So certainly they can trade Apple, right? Oh, I've been to Walmart, so certainly I can trade Walmart. But nothing resonated more in a tangible way with me than commodities. I mean, this was the grocery store to the world. I was trading corn. I was trading crude, cocoa. I love softs, coffee and sugar, cotton. I loved soft. So those markets resonated with me. They made sense to me a whole lot more than stocks. Still do. After commodities, I definitely have an affinity for currencies.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. I mean, that's why Apple is traded so often by retail traders, is because it's relatable. It's a product they know, so they think that they could go in and trade it. But until you see how the market moves, you really don't know if it's really going to fit your type of trading. I mean, investing is a whole other thing. We could go on a tangent here, you and I, between trading and investing. But I want to talk about also what type of trader you are. Once again, starting at a very early age, I'm sure you've tried all different types of trading, you know, scalping, maybe day trading, swing trading, options. So what kind of trader are you now?
Sure. I got very lucky. I think the kind of trader I am now is really just an evolution of exactly what I was doing back in the late 80s, which was I got my hands on some printouts at a local high school or college, I think it was college, these binders of Dow's newsletters. I don't even recall anymore how I got my hands on them, but I got my hands on those, and I still am very influenced by Dow theory. And the part of Dow theory that resonated the most was the understanding that he was such a student of behavioral finance, which now has become, thanks to a lot of different authors, it's, you know, thinking fast, thinking slow. We get this whole behavioral finance, behavioral economics. But I think he really was the grandfather of that. And understanding the four market trends, not two. I think most market participants think the market's either heading up or heading down. And Charles Dow resonated with me where, one, it was a psychological type background. That was my, you know, I had a passion for that. And number two, it really explained that there are four market trends. And it was my job to figure that market trend out first. You know, mark up, mark down, accumulation, distribution, and then get to work. And so I think Charles Dow, I migrated over to Richard Schaubacher. And again, these are all books and printouts that I was able to get because they were what, published in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. So it was very much an education of the classics. And I never really found much more for that. Everything else I just sort of learned as I went along.
So your time frame is not really short term, but it's not really too long term either. What's your average hold time for a trade?
Sure. So trades have sort of three segments for me. There's a trade, you know, you and I might be in and out of something in one day because that's just the way the structure of the market developed on a 5-minute chart. And I don't mind it, a short term approach, but it still goes back to Charles Dow. Can I find the market structure? Can I find that market trend? But mostly, if I had my way, it would be daily time frames and I would stick with that. And if I have a daily move that was, say, a momentum move that broke out of a channel and it moved for 3 or 4 days, and that's completely arbitrary, but if it hit my target, that's a trade. But if it continues on, if a breakout continues like we had in natural gas back in 2018, had a choppy market, I kept buying those oversold buys, and finally it broke out. Well, now a range-bound trade transitioned into a trend. And once I get into a trend, I'm looking for a ride of at least 3 to 5 weeks, 3 to 6 weeks. Because when I have that trend on my side, you know, I live in Florida, I love to surf, I want to take that wave as far into shore as I can.
Let's talk more about your process. Take us through a day in the life of Raghi. Before you begin to trade, talk to us about your preparation.
My preparation is really going to be a little different depending upon if I'm going to be day trading on that particular day, because I don't like the bigger picture structure of a market. Think maybe mid-January. For anybody thinking about the markets right now, if you think about the S&Ps mid-January, where after Powell had sent the market higher, we sort of had a handful of days between about the 8th and the 16th of the month where we were kind of in a range. Except for times like that, I'd rather be looking at longer term time frames and trend following. But there'll be times I shorten the time frame. I want to get up early because I think one of the worst things traders can do is spend the morning, especially after the bell, sort of warming up. If you're not ready to go when the whistle blows, by the time you're warmed up mentally or however, it's the day is going to be half done. So I think a lot of traders just sort of belly up to the computers between around 9:15 or 9:30 and think they're going to be ready to go. Most aren't. And then they start to get into flow around 11 o'clock and it's just too late to me. So getting up early, number one, getting a feel for what headlines are moving the market. So I get an idea of what sort of, as I maybe not so endearingly call them, the sheeple out there, what are they going to respond to today? And then I'll start to break down the time frames to find out where I've got clarity. And if it's the daily time frame, I know it's going to be a pretty easy day. I'm going to be parking a limit order and waiting for the market to come to me. And if I don't have structure, I'm going to be shortening the time frame. And now I know the work begins because day trading sure feels like work. I admire anybody who could do that short-term stuff day in and day out. I only do it when I have to.
So let's dig a little bit deeper. So to me, it sounds like you get up early, you're reading the headlines, the news, what's happening in the market, trying to develop a theme as to, you know, what's going on that day. Then you take a look at your charts, and specifically, what time frames are you going through? Walk us through that.
So once I've just gotten a glance at the headlines, I don't want to dive deep into that because I don't really feel headline psychology is what's going to move the market. But I know that's what most people are going to be responding to. I have a macro, you know, bigger picture that I want to fit everything into. But I'm going to stick with the daily. If I can find clarity on the daily, you know, mostly I'm going to take a look at things like bonds, gold, US dollar, euro, silver, copper, crude. I mean, that's where I'm going to make a beeline for first. And then I'm going to get a feel for maybe what the yen might be doing intraday, seeing if it's being bought or sold. But if I can stick with those daily timeframes first, build out my ranges. I have ranges that I'll look at the top and bottom of the range to get an idea if I should be taking profit on an older position or where my next re-entry is going to be. So it's a lot of time on daily timeframes, probably a good 30 to 45 minutes.
Okay, you're using technicals and fundamentals, but it sounds to me like you are much more technical based.
Well, I mean, if I'm looking at earnings as a fundamental, if I'm looking at individual data releases as fundamentals, I never want to ignore those. I mean, those are going to obviously explode volatility. It's going to change the range that I'm expecting on any given day. But the cumulative look at, say, data points, inflation growth, mostly what the M2 money supply is doing, that's going to be my macro picture. And that's very much that bigger picture macro that I was talking about.
Yeah.
But I won't ignore the fundamentals. But I think no matter what kind of trader you are, you have to look at the calendar. You know what my analogy is? And most people know the sport. If you watch the UFC now, as opposed to maybe a mixed martial art UFC fan from 20 years ago, people walked into that octagon with one skill set. They were judokas, they were karate, they were Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Nowadays, you never find anyone that one-dimensional. You know, everybody comes in with a stand-up game, with a ground game, with a takedown defense. That's what I think we as traders have to be now. You've got to have a respect for fundamentals. You've got to have a respect for technicals. And I think price rules all, but you can't come in one dimensional anymore. So I think those days for traders are gone. You need to come in like a mixed martial artist does, all facets of the game.
Let's talk about the technical analysis tools that you use, your favorites, specifically the ones that you're using when you're looking at your daily chart.
Sure. Charles Dow introduced the idea of the four market trends. And then for the first two or three years, all it was trying to figure out is, aside from, say, a 20, 50, 200 cross, or aside from these lagging moving average type approaches to understanding the market trend, I just went about trying to figure out, is there a way that I could differentiate the moment a transitional market starts to trend, or the moment a trending market transitions into chop or starts to accumulate and move into a channel? So what I did is I played around with a lot of exponential moving averages, settled on the 34 period on a high, low, and a close, and I color-coded my candles according to where they were against that moving average band, if you will, that wave of the 34 EMA high and the close and the low. So I have these color-coded candles where I can at a glance determine if I feel we're in a downtrend, an uptrend, in consolidation or chop. So that's my touchstone. It's something that I cooked up many, many years ago. It used to be a 34 simple when I did it by hand. And then, you know, I started calculating the 34 EMA by hand. And then, you know, we're spoiled with all these great charting platforms now. But that's what I did early on.
I'm so glad you brought up color coding, because I think that this is something that traders can be pretty lazy with. Yeah. For me, I go in and I create a chart template, and every moving average and every horizontal line and every single tool that I use, I color code it. So on every single chart and every single time frame, when I pull up that moving average or I put a horizontal line, I know what that represents to me. And I don't have different colors in different charts representing the same moving averages. So this way, when I'm looking at the market, looking at my charts, I don't have to think about what moving average that is, or why did I draw that line there? Everything is color coded. And I'm a real stickler for this, because I think we're making so many decisions as traders. I don't want to be sitting there thinking about what line is that or what moving average is that. Are you the same way? Are you a stickler like me, where you just color code everything and create a template?
You said it perfectly, and I love it. So you've got a template that you know is your Anthony template. And the minute that's up, you know exactly what moving average are, what their settings are, what that color. I do the same thing. So the color, the candles are color coded. The moving averages that I use are color coded. And then I did one other thing where I still liked the way in which moving averages communicated a chop or a trending market to me, but I wasn't ever a fan of watching moving averages interact with each other. I was a bigger fan of what do moving averages do with each other plus price. Like, it was much more interesting to me what candles were going to do when they reach a certain moving average, as opposed to, you know, an 8 crossing a 21 alone. So I always added price into all those different moving averages. So everything is color coded, every dot, every line, every candle. It's like the legend of a map, right? I mean, how can you read a map without a legend?
You talked about how you made it personal to you. What do you believe your edge is in using your moving averages in your strategy?
The edge I think any of us have is our ability to know our pitch. I'm a big fan of H.A. Dorfman's sports psychology books, and one of them is called The Mental Keys to Hitting. It's a short book, maybe less than 150 pages. And I think for traders, it's a lot like being a batter at the plate. We know what our pitch looks like. And if you don't know what your pitch looks like, you're never going to have trading success, or it'll be sporadic at best. And so what I think about my edge, it's for me a trending market. If I have consistency in the color of the candles, and I look for green candles in an uptrend, red in a downtrend, and it's basically, again, predicated on being above the 34 EMA trio or below, first of all, I want to find a trend. A trend to me is always going to be an edge for nearly everybody. I mean, you could be sloppy and do fine in the trend. You could be a great retracement trader and do even better. But trends are very forgiving, so why not trade the most forgiving kind of market?
Do you have a specific way that you determine a trend? I mean, I know it could be just as easy as a trend line, but you know, I was actually one time speaking with a trader friend, and we talked about how all of us could look at a chart and really almost see a different trend. I mean, you could just go on Twitter and hear how people have different ideas right now about what the S&P is. Is it trending higher or is it trending lower? You know, I mean, I think that that is always up for the debate, because it's in the eye of the beholder. So what does the market have to prove to you to be in a trend?
You are so right about that. I think most, say, fights on FinTwit or any kind of disagreement on the market could be settled with what time frame are you looking at, right? So that's number one. What time frame are you looking at? So the thing that I'll do to determine whether or not the market is in a trend is go right back to the relationship of the candles above and below the 34 EMA on the high and the 34 EMA on the low. And so if my candles are plotting above the 34 EMA on the high, they're all green. They'll be light green for a close up, and they'll be dark green for a close down, so I can keep that more traditional Japanese candlestick look. And I know a down close versus an up close, but they're going to be color coded based upon where they are in relation to those moving averages. And if they close inside those two moving averages, the 34 EMA on the high and the 34 EMA on the low, the candles go blue. So I know immediately that there's some sort of neutral or transitional market that's happening. Charles Dow might call that accumulation distribution, depending upon the volatility in the range. And if we're trading below the 34 EMA on the low, all my candles are going to be red. An up candle is going to be a light red, a down candle is going to be a dark red, but they're all going to be red. So I can take a look literally at, and I do, you know, 8 to 10 monitors and a number of charts on each. And just by the color coding, as you mentioned earlier, you know, am I above or below, say, a 200 EMA? Am I above or below the wave? All that's completely color coded. So that's how I determine the trend with those EMAs and where we are in respect to them.
I love it. You have a process for determining the trend. You're not just going up there and saying, hey, look at this. This looks like it's in a trend and drawing a line and then all of a sudden looking for trades, right? I
mean, Oh, gosh. I'm such a heretic, Anthony. I have actually a saying I need to put on a T-shirt. Friends don't let friends draw trend lines. I haven't drawn a trend line probably, no kidding, in 7 to 10 years.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Let's go through a trade example. I think we all get the gist as to, you know, your preparation and a lot about your process for how a trade sets up. Now take us through that trade from soup to nuts. Talk to us about how you're getting in. Talk to us how you're determining your stop and then your exit point.
You got it. And I love that you said process. I mean, process to me is the smartest, sexiest word in the world, because what it suggests is you have something that's repeatable. And so I love that you mentioned that. I don't hear that enough in the trading world, you know. So as far as the process goes, I want to find an idea. Usually it's going to be rooted in the futures or currency markets. In my mind and in my experience, that rules everything. You know, stocks are going to do more or less what monetary policy is going to let them do, or the dollar or yields, you know. So I look at everything from that perspective. Not a right or wrong, but that's where I like to be anchored. So I'll find a narrative either in commodities or currency. So one good example in the commodity space would be looking at the long bond. And before Jay Powell turned accommodative in January, he was still gonzo, hawkish, and not sounding accommodative at all in November, December. In fact, in December, he dropped the hammer on how much he was going to keep the balance sheet, dwindling down and letting those MBS and the treasuries roll off the balance sheet. He was not going to be looking at cutting rates. I mean, it was not what the market wanted to hear in December. But by then, we had already started to short yield or buy bonds. And it was a really simple double bottom that occurred. And then my candle started trading above the 34 EMA on the high. So I had not only a technical setup in the double bottom between October to November, my candles went green. And it's kind of important for when I say the candles go green, because I never want to be saying, well, an indicator told me to do it, because as if trading is that easy. But in this case, I hadn't gone green since the end of August. These are the first green grab candles. What I call them, grab stands for green, red, and blue. These are the first green candles that I had seen, according to the way that I look at a trend, since the end of August on the 30-year bond. So between the narrative that even though Powell had not committed to becoming more accommodative, that he wasn't going to pause rates, the bond market was already starting to price that in. In fact, by the end of November, the bond market had crossed through the technical threshold of the 200. And I think that 200, again, it's a random thing until you realize how many people look at it. And so, again, I tend to upset some technicians when I say this, but one of the most powerful aspects of technical analysis is that self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't think there's anything magical about a 200. What's magical, what's real, and why everybody should look at it is because so many people are looking at it and they're going to respond in a very obvious way. We know this about major psychological levels, anything that ends in a double zero. You know, why is $50 crude such a magical number? It's not magical in terms of turning a profit for the Saudis or the shale producers. It's just a whole round number that we tend to gravitate towards as humans. So those are the kind of things that I'm going to focus in on. So it's, again, going back to how influenced I was by sort of this behavioral finance. What are people thinking at certain numbers that I got from Charles Dow? So bonds went up. I got long bonds. And then along with that, we got long construction and housing, because just historically, you watch this cycle going back to process enough, and you know that housing and construction are going to go along for the ride, and they have ever since.
Okay, so I understand how you got in. It was a fundamental story. You explained that with Powell, and then you looked at your charts, and the technicals were confirming what you were seeing or hearing from that fundamental story. So I understand how you got in. Talk to us about how you determine where you're wrong, because one of the first things I learned in this industry is know where you're getting out before you're getting in. So how did you determine your stop or your risk price?
Oh, I love that question. So let me tell you a great example of where I was wrong, and this will resonate, I think, with a lot of folks. So the same narrative back in October of 18, we had contracting CPI. We had also GDP ticking down. Forget that Q2 spike. That was the front running of the China tariffs. But we had a contracting GDP. We had contracting CPI. Globally, Europe was already in a massive slowdown. Emerging markets were a train wreck. So come October 2018, I'm thinking this is a perfect storm. I mean, you know, I'm ready to short this market. I wasn't in February and I wasn't in June. We didn't quite have the emerging markets wreck that we saw. And we hadn't had as many contracting, you know, CPI only peaked in, say, August of last year. So come October, when we started to roll over, what I had was a move from those green grab candles, those green colored candles, because we were trading above the 34 EMA high. They went neutral. And then, of course, on the 10th, everything went sideways. But that was really the cue. So we spent October, November, and even into December shorting into the midterm election, shorting into the G20 rally, and then finally shorting into the post-Powell January 4, 2019 little powwow that he had with Yellen and Bernanke, and that televised little sit down that they had where he uttered the word patience like he was reading from his book report. And we had that. And I shorted into that too. And that ultimately ended up being wrong. The candles went blue, the candles went green, and that was the end of that ride. And we finally saw the kind of monetary policy shift that the bulls were just, you know, on bended knee begging for.
How do you size your positions? Are you scaling in? Are you in all at once? Sounds to me like you're scaling in. Are you always trading the same contract size? Are there different scenarios for different contract size positions? Talk to us about that.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. Anytime I sit down and I see two traders like you, myself, that position sizing, that's the $64,000 question, right? That's always the question. And I love it. So I look at every trade as having an aggressive, a moderate, and a conservative entry level. And it's all going to be predicated on where you think the trade is no longer valid. I don't use a percentage. I don't use a dollar. That to me kind of inches into sort of precious snowflakeville, where it only matters to me, right? So to me, I want to look at, why do I want to short this? And then also, where is the resistance that will tell me that the short selling pressure is going to basically either exhaust or even reverse? So the whole idea to me is this concept of point of validity. And point of validity is simply where you say, okay, this is where that trade is no longer valid. So if it's a downtrend, whatever you use to qualify what the trend is, when that's no longer signaling a trending signal, that's the validity. You got to be out. So the aggro or the aggressive level is going to be usually the first opportunity, but the one with the greatest risk. And it's one that I'm going to position into either with options or very small position sizing, because it's my least favorable risk reward ratio. By the time I've got an entry zone right up against the stop loss, that's almost always going to be my largest position. And it's the one that I've got the most latitude to take heat on, because number one, it's as good a price as I'm going to get within the context of the trade. And it's as low a risk as I'm going to get, because it's butted up right against the stop. And that's going to by far be the largest. So I will leg in, but in that almost inverse upside down pyramiding style.
Yeah, for me, I just use no one to trade big, small, or not at all. And so
I
really make it basic.
It.
Yeah, right. I want to go back to something that you said, because I think this is a very, very important point to talk about. You mentioned how your biggest positions are when you get in closest to your stop. Now, for me, I that same type of situation happens to me, because I have a risk per trade. So my contract size is going to be determined how far away I am from the stop. So contract size wise, my biggest positions are always closest to my stop, because the difference in price from entry to stop is the smallest. So it doesn't necessarily mean that those are my riskiest positions. Some of my riskiest positions in terms of dollar amount could be small positions that have very wide stops. And this is why I tell people, don't be held by a contract size. You have to know when to trade big, when to trade small, or when not to trade, all based upon your risk per trade.
I love it. You know, I'm going to use that, Anthony, big, small. I wrote that down. I love that. You know, when I shorted the S&P in November and I shorted the NASDAQ at the same time, it was a large position. It was the first opportunity that I had to short it. It was into a nice, exhaustive midterm election rally. That was a large position for me. But as we kept moving lower, I made my position size about the same, but then it was within those three zones. So the first short that I made after Powell mentioned the word pause, and this would have been, say, the 7th of January, that was my smallest position. By the time we got to the 15th, and I'm still shorting small amounts, by the time we got to the 15th and I'm pushing 2,600, that was the largest position I had. And that was the one that I knew was going to be wrong within about 14 or 15 points, which on a daily time frame really isn't a lot for an S&P trader. So those of you that are day trading going 14 or 15 S&P points, you know, remember the S&P on any given day could move 40, 45 points on a 68% probability. So, you know, 14 to 15 points in a daily is such little risk. And so you're absolutely right. That was my largest position before things just, you know, ended for me.
Talk to us about your exit strategy. Let's just say that you're in a trade, and we talked about how your time frame could be a day because price could get you out. I mean, let's face it, markets are volatile. They can get you out. But let's just say that you're in a trade that just that keeps going your way. You know, a lot of people always say, I struggle to hold on to my winners. Who doesn't, right? I mean, it's a very hard thing to do because once you have a good trade on, all you can think about is cashing out and putting the money in your account. But when you have a trade on that's going your way, do you trail stops? Do you do anything to protect what you have? Or do you just still continue to let it play out? And, you know, if all of a sudden things turn, then that's just how you get out.
That's a terrific question. I think what happens, it's really an interesting psychological trap. I think of a lot of traders had a difficult time earlier in their career. And the first time a trade goes in the black for them, they're already antsy. They don't want it to go negative. They've had too many losses. That those wounds are fresh. But aside from those psychological traps, I'll go back to what I do every single day in my journal. I've got a whole column dedicated to the upper and lower end of the range on the daily time frame. And I know that I want to be a buyer at the bottom of the range. I want to be a seller at the top of the range. It's just using support and resistance. And going back to how close to my stop can I build a low risk position? So the other thing that I do is I have a study that I use and help develop with some buddies of mine where they had an enormous amount of data coming in so they can automate chart pattern alerts. But then they realized that they could actually, with all that data coming in, they could break down the historical price movement patterns, not chart patterns, but in other words, how many points does the S&P typically want to move between, you know, 9 and 10 for the last 6 months? You know, what's the 68% probability of a range for the S&P during that time of day or that day of week, etc.? So I use data like that where I can use a high probability for price movement. I know that one of the most volatile hours of the day are 10 to 11 Eastern and then 3 to 4 Eastern, and the S&P tends to tip top out around 19, 20 points. So if I know that's the probability and that's the higher end, I'll place my profit targets and stop losses accordingly. And going back to the stops, to me, an exit's an exit. Whether I'm taking profit exit or whether I'm getting stopped out exit, I will use those numbers so I don't smother the trade. I think that if I were using dollar amounts or percentage amounts, that doesn't mean anything to the pattern of the market. That doesn't mean anything to the personality of the market. So every market has those numbers and every market has those ranges, and that's what I use.
Two quick questions before we get into rapid fire. First question, actually take whichever one you want first. I want to talk about how you journal trades because you've already mentioned that. And I also want to talk about trading psychology. So whichever one you want to talk about first is fine by me.
Well, I'll touch on the psychology because that's everything. You know, as far as understanding human behavior, whether you're going to quantify that to a price, whether you're going to quantify that to time of day, the psychology of a 9:30 to 10 o'clock clearing, and the psychology of the last hour of the trading day, is very different than the psychology of, say, 11:30 to 1:30. I think day traders know this pretty darn well. I think we know psychology when it comes to seasonals. You know, we're in the very early stages of the run-up, typically in energies, as we go into the driving season. That, to me, is also psychology to a certain extent. But it all goes back to Charles Dow. You know, are we in a psychology that's going to support an uptrend? Is there confusion? Therefore, it's more distribution chop. Is it more like a wait and see, low volume environment, like an accumulation or narrow channel? Or is everyone hit the panic button and we've got the markdown or the downtrend? So to me, you can't extract psychology. In fact, every candle or every bar chart that we look at is just, to me, just the summary of what people are thinking that given day. And then you slice those time frames into 1 minute or weeklies. We're just then now collecting that opinion for that amount of time. So candles are people. That's the way I look at it. Candles are people.
I like that. What about your thoughts on journaling?
Journaling. I think pen and paper is very important. I think if you want to remember something, you write it down. And so every single day, I know there's a lot of great electronic alternatives, but I'm still a fan of pen and paper. So I carry this book with me everywhere. It's got my risk to reward ranges on there, the price movement ranges that I was talking about. It has my watch lists. I don't dear diary my journal. You know, I don't talk about, I think that's something that early on in a trading career, you know, what were you thinking when you pushed it on a bad trade? What were you thinking when you got in aggressively? That's good in the early stages. My journaling now really is numbers, watch lists, levels, reminders for certain fundamental or macroeconomic, geopolitical events that might be happening. You know, are we anticipating hearing something about the trade war? Are we anticipating hearing from Merkel? Does Powell have a speech that day? I'll jot that kind of stuff down so I don't forget it and be broadsided by it. But that's really what the journaling is now, just making sure that I'm putting all my ideas in one place so I can flip through it a quarter at a time and know if I'm heading in the right direction or not.
Great stuff, Raghi. Next up, we have some rapid-fire questions if you're ready for those.
Let's do it.
All right, everybody. Our rapid-fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Access the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. And now you can trade cryptocurrency, spot, and derivative markets side by side. For more information, please visit tradingtechnologies.com. First question, what trader has influenced your life the most and why?
I have to say Charles Dow. I don't know that I'd call him a trader, but Charles Dow for sure. I would not have developed the tools that I have. I would not understand the four market trends without Dow. Probably close second is Richard Schaubacher to understand what all these squiggles and lines actually really mean and how to draw them correctly on a chart.
What was one of the hardest things for you to overcome in trading?
I'm very conservative by nature. I'd have to say on a scale of trigger happy to gun shy, I'm definitely much more gun shy. I'm less likely to want to pull the trigger on a trade. So, you know, trusting in my process, again, you mentioned that word so many times. I'm so happy you did. Trusting my process and every time the criteria is met, just pulling the trigger.
How has your trading process evolved over the years?
It's evolved in that I just know more. You know, 30 years in, what I was ignorant to, you know, could have filled volumes, and it still can, but it's definitely this receding pool of ignorance, which is great. I know more. I've seen more cycles. I think years don't necessarily do it. It's how many cycles have you seen? You know, you've been trading. You know, we've seen long-term capital management. Well, if you saw long-term capital management, the blow up in 2001 didn't really look that different. If you saw long-term capital management, that cycle, you also said, wait a minute, 08 sort of, it may not rhyme, but it sure does look a lot alike, you know, sound a lot alike. So I think you have to see those cycles. And when you do, it's easy to keep responding to what's familiar.
What is one attribute that you believe every trader should have?
The ability to walk away. I think that traders oftentimes come from a sort of clock in and clock out mentality. They were employees at some point. And we don't live in a time-based economy when we're traders. The market doesn't care that I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do my homework. It lives in a results-based economy. So I think to stop thinking like an employee and to start thinking like what you are in, which is a results-based economy.
Favorite book about trading?
Wow, my favorite book about trading is probably What I Learned Losing $1 Million by Moynihan and Paul. That book just, continues to really just, we go through the five stages of grief every time we have a losing trade. And the sooner we can acknowledge where we are within that cycle, the sooner we can acknowledge a loss and move on. That was a big book for me.
Favorite movie about trading?
Yeah, I'm sure there's some popular ones. I don't know, Trading Places and Rogue Trader. I don't know that I actually have one, but I'm open to one. If you can suggest one, I'll go look it up today.
Trading Places is my favorite. And The Big Short is another one I think is great. Those are the two most popular on this show by far.
Excellent.
What's the best piece of advice that you've received about trading?
The best piece of advice about trading that I ever received is that if you get really good at one thing, to stick with it. I see people find something that works and then they abandon it because they think they've evolved past, say, let's do something like chart patterns or simple, basic, rudimentary trading approaches that have worked for years and years, if not decades. If something works, don't stop doing it. Add another layer to it or find another time frame that approach might work on. But I find oddly that traders are always, they have shiny object syndrome, right? And I think they always look for the next biggest thing rather than saying, I've got something that works, which means I'm doing better than 90% of traders and investors out there. They abandon what works, shockingly.
If you could go back in time and give the younger you a piece of advice, what would it be?
Oh gosh, if I could go back in time, I would say just stick with it. Keep doing what you're doing. You're on the right path, because I doubted it a lot. I was such a heretic and self-taught early on when I was told later on how things are supposed to be done. I'm glad that I had the fortitude to ignore it. So just stick with it. You're going to be fine.
If you had an elevator pitch me your edge in trading, what would you say?
Have your trading rooted in what has worked for not 10 years or 20 years, but for 100 years. Because trading, despite the technology that's allowed us better access, better transparency, we as humans haven't changed all that much. So find the things that worked in the years of Charles Dow, in the years of Richard Schaubach, in the years of even Richard Wyckoff, and find a way to keep that as the foundation of your trading. Because what's tried and true continues to work. Add technology to that.
Last question for today. What's your favorite thing to do when you're not trading?
There's something to do other than trading?
Apparently.
Probably reading. I love to read.
Cool. Raghi, this was awesome. Where could people find you on Twitter? And give us a website to check out.
Sure. So at Twitter, Facebook, all the social media stuff, it's at Raghi Horner, R-A-G-H-E-E, Horner, H-O-R-N-E-R. And I hang my hat over at simplertrading.com.
Raghi, this was awesome. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show today.
It's been an honor, really. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's been great talking to you. And we're the family that does the color coding. I love it. I that makes me so happy. And thank you for driving home process for everybody. I just love it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.